that it's an insurance company. The point I'm making is that the procedural rules which define insurance companies and proceedings against them don't mention the fund. And the fund rules that define its procedures don't mention insurance companies or adopt the rules that apply to proceedings against insurance companies. Now, I anticipate that the Attorney General will almost certainly tell this court about three cases and tell you that these cases can stand for the proposition that the fund is to be treated like an insurance company. One case is Industrial Accident Board versus Mears from the 1940s. The other two cases are Industrial Accident Board versus Guidry and Industrial Accident Board versus Parker from the early 1960s. Let me begin by just quoting from the Parker case. That's the most recent of those three cases. On the proposition that the fund should be regarded as an insurance company, the court literally said, the fund may be substituted for the compensation insurer in the administration of the law to the extent necessary to accomplish the purposes of the second injury fund. However, this does not mean that a substitution was intended, for to substitute would result in a conflict or hiatus in provisions or a nullification of the purposes of the compensation law. In other words, those cases say you don't just call this fund an insurance company and treat it accordingly. The first case I mentioned, Mears, was not a Section 5 case on jurisdiction. Mears was a venue case. Venue is not jurisdictional. If you have erroneous venue in a workers' compensation case, the court just transfers the case to the county of proper venue. The Parker and the Guidry cases were also not jurisdiction cases. They were notice and claim cases, i.e., did the claimant have to file a separate notice and separate claim for compensation against the fund? At that time, the answer was yes, because the statute was different at that time. But even in workers' compensation cases, notice and claim are not jurisdictional. They may be waived for good cause, and you can't waive jurisdiction. The court either has jurisdiction or it hasn't jurisdiction. And as I'll mention in a few moments, as of today, the law is that one does not even have to file a claim against the fund. There is no such requirement. Now, let me point out a separate feature. Under the Workers' Compensation Act, insurance companies are not the only entities which might pay workers' compensation benefits. Other entities are the state. State employees get hurt. The University of Texas or Texas A&M employees, their employees get hurt. Political subdivision employees, for example, employees of cities or counties. In each of those cases, one does proceed under Article 8307, Section 5, that is, the 20 days to appeal, 20 days to file suit. But one does so because the enabling statutes bringing each of those entities under the workers' compensation law expressly says this will be done pursuant to Article 8307, Section 5. It seems that if the legislature felt that Section 5 could be applied to them by implication, it would be unnecessary to specifically set out that Section 5 applied to them. However, the legislature expressly brought them under Section 5. Not so the fund.
If Section 5 doesn't apply to the fund, what does?
I think that the answer to that is that the fund can be put on notice informally or formally at any time after the insurance company has paid. If the Industrial Accident Board administers it and wishes to voluntarily pay out of the fund, it may do so. If not, litigation may be initiated.
So, in this case, you could have continued the suit against the carrier, obtained your verdict, and then brought action against it.
I believe I could have done so, Your Honor. I did not do so because the carrier conceded its liability and then on its own filed a motion to join the fund as a third-party defendant.
And was it only after the carrier conceded its liability that the fund had any liability, potential or otherwise?
Absolutely. The statute is very clear that the fund does not pay anyone anything until after the carrier has paid the combination of benefits for the on-the-job injury. Then the fund pays the remainder of total and permanent benefits if, in fact, the previous and the subsequent injury combined to totally and permanently disable the claimant.
So it's only after.
Yes, sir.
It's been determined that the carrier's liability creates subsequent liability on the fund that you could ever put the fund on notice.
It's uncanny how the question has been posed at this point in my argument, because there are really three historical phases to the existence of the fund. From 1947 to 1971, a claimant who wanted money from the fund had to proceed directly against the fund, and under the statutes as they existed then, had to file a separate notice, a separate claim, and get a separate award from the Industrial Accident Board and proceed. It was still only after the insurance company paid that the fund was at risk of paying any of its money out. This flip-flopped 180 degrees in 1971. The legislature rewrote the statute and said the claimant will get everything out of the insurance company. Then, if the insurance company has paid total and permanent benefits for the second injury, the same case, the insurance company may then proceed any time after it's paid these benefits to recoup its money from the fund. Now, how could the insurance company defend itself in a lawsuit from the board award, pay its money out, and then later file a claim for recoupment of its money from the fund if it was jurisdictional then that it had to proceed against the fund simultaneously? Well, of course it couldn't. It could proceed only after it had paid. In 1977, the legislature changed the proceeding again, but it changed it in three ways. First, the claimant now does proceed against the fund. But the legislature expressly removed a separate notice and claim by the claimant against the fund and said that just filing a workers' compensation claim against the employer is deemed notice and claim against the fund. In other words, it removed any procedural barrier that may have existed under the old statute. I don't think that I strongly enough put this in my brief, and so if I don't say anything successfully this morning, I'd like to say this one thing. It defies my imagination why it would not be jurisdictional between 1971 and 1977 for an insurance company to make its claim against the fund, since it could make a claim any time after it finally paid. Yet without any change in the pertinent provisions of Article 8307, Section 5, after 1977, it would be jurisdictional for a claimant to do so. Why would it not be jurisdictional during that 7-year period when the insurance company had to make a claim? And without any change, it now would be jurisdictional for a claimant to do so.
Well, one reason is because the carrier, if the carrier has to proceed against the fund, has some incentive to oppose the claimant's claim. Whereas if the carrier does not have to proceed against the fund and only the claimant does, then the carrier has no reason to defend against the claim of total and permanent incapacity. And in essence, nobody in the trial court opposing that position.
But the fund does not owe anyone from 1971 to 1977 until after the carrier has paid benefits, nor does it owe anyone today until after the carrier has paid benefits. The carrier certainly has the underlying desire to not pay a dime that it doesn't owe, whether for total and permanent or for the underlying on-the-job injury. 100% of a leg is still a substantial amount of money for a carrier to pay. The other problem that I had with the decision of the Court of Appeals was its decision that a claim against the fund must be prosecuted in a single joint appeal against the carrier. I think that violates the literal language of 8306 section 12c1, which by reading the word simultaneously into a statute where the words after and remainder are the active words. What would be the fund's position if the plaintiff said, or if the trial court said, fund, you pay first. Mrs. Martinez gets her money from you first and can get her money from the insurance company later. Well, the fund would say no. That's not what the law reads. The law literally says, in addition to an after payment by the insurance company, the employee should be paid the remainder of the compensation due for total and permanent out of the fund. The carrier's payment is a condition precedent. It's not a condition simultaneous. It's not a condition subsequent. It's worth noting in this case that at trial, finally, the insurance company stipulated its liability for 100% of the leg, and the fund then stipulated that that was an adequate predicate for its liability in the event of total impairment. In other words, there's no charge or challenge in this case about the sufficiency of the evidence, which I think is one of the questions Justice Heck raised. There are some practical reasons why the proceeding that the Court of Appeals said was mandatory, was jurisdictional, would not be correct. First, the Industrial Accident Board has all the claim files on all the claimants. It knows as much as the parties do about the medical condition of any claimant who is before it. Yet no separate claim is required to be made. The statute doesn't require a separate award even to be made. The other problem is that not every injury is cognizable at some given point in the claim process to be a total and permanent injury. Torn cartilages, arthritic feet, carpal tunnels affect different people at different times and in different ways. And it seems unnecessary to conclude that it is jurisdictional to say that one must assume the worst at the beginning of every case. The result of that would require joining the fund as a party in every appeal based on a specific injury case, whether at that point in time it appeared to be a total permanent case or not. The reason why is, how could one go back and sue later if during the course of the litigation it did develop medically that this person wasn't just suffering from a broken arm, but was suffering from a broken arm plus something else that totally and permanently finally disabled this person? I'd like to point out that the fund is not deprived by this procedure of any right to defend anything. The insurance company has the burden in every case to defend its interests as fully as it desires. The fund is not going to be prejudiced in any way by the insurance company's defense on notice of injury, claim, award, timely filing of appeal against the carrier, or non-payment of benefits, because if the carrier wins on any of those issues, the fund doesn't owe anything anyway.
But if the carrier doesn't, in other words, the second injury fund's defense rests in the hands of the carrier.
No, I think the second injury fund's underlying risk does lie in the hands of the carrier. I think there's a question, and I don't think that it's ever been answered, and the question is, would what happens in a case solely between the claimant and the carrier be res judicata or collateral estoppel in a second proceeding against the fund? Let me answer it this way. It certainly would as to the claimant. For example, if in the underlying lawsuit between the carrier and the fund, the decision was that the workers' compensation rate applicable at that time was $175 per week, I think that the claimant would be stopped from coming back in a second suit against the fund and trying to initiate new facts to make the fund have to pay $231 a week. I think it would be res judicata that $175 is the maximum benefit applicable in that case. I think if the carrier won on any particular issue that one might want to raise, for example, no injury in the course of employment, the claimant would be precluded by that decision from coming back and claiming against the fund and relitigating an issue he had already lost. It would seem like that would be a two-way street.
That question's not really before us here.
I'm sorry, Ron.
That question's not really before us here.
No, only in the incidental way, and that is what would be the effect of the changing the decision in future litigation. I think the other effect of it, though, is to say that the fund, by sticking this unwritten rule into the procedure, that is, deciding that even though the statute doesn't provide for it, Section 5, and even though it is clearly different than what 8306 Section 12C says about paying afterwards, I think if this unwritten procedural jurisdictional rule is put into the fund claims process, the effect of it is going to be to dump the entire burden of these claims back on the business community, the employers, and the insurance companies. Because this unwritten rule is going to make it so difficult for claimants to proceed against the fund that they're going to just hang on to that insurance company to the bitter end of every case. They're going to try to extend an effect of foot injury into the leg injury into the general injury simply because they know they'll have some chance of doing that and very little chance of recovering against the fund. It's hard to imagine how anything could create more disharmony or nullify the purpose in the fund than to wind up fashioning a rule which shifts all the burden right back onto the business community, the employers, and the insurance companies who have already paid what they owe.
Is there some other limitation on the length of time during which claims against the fund can be brought?
I think that it would be like the rule in contribution or indemnity cases, that must begin as of the time that the carrier has paid its liability or its liability is established. The statute would begin to run at that point.
And it would just fall under the ordinary statute of claim for money, and perhaps that's a 4-year.
There not being any other statutory enclosure, I think that's the case, Your Honor. But I think it would begin as of the time the carrier's condition preceding is established and met.
Counsel, in as much as the whole workers' compensation scheme is a total statutory.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does the common law have the power to draft common law rules into a total statutorily created remedy system?
I think the answer is no, and I think it's been expressed by this court in the Johnson versus Second Injury Fund case in 1985. This court, and I'm aware that it was a divided court to some extent, but this court held that in second injury fund litigation, procedures regarding the fund are statutory and nothing may be placed into those procedures by implication. The rule was called, I hope I say this, expressio unius est exclusio alterius, meaning that to enumerate one particular item or a series of items is to exclude anything not mentioned. Section 5, the statute providing for jurisdictional 2020 appeals and suits, expressly mentions the association, not the fund. 83091 and 83092 expressly mention the association, but not the fund. All these liable payers, the state, the universities, the cities, whose employees get hurt and for whom they must pay, are expressly included under Section 5 by their enabling statutes, not so the fund. By bringing all of them in by an express statutory scheme, I think this court said in the Johnson case in this expressio unius rule that their express mention means they're included, and the funds not having been mentioned expressly excludes it, and it can't be brought in by implication.
Counsel, am I correct in my recollection that most of these political subdivisions, and particularly the state supported colleges and universities, were each brought in a separate statute?
Yes. For example, the University of Texas, I believe, is Article 8309H, Texas A&M's 8309G, political subdivisions 8309D. They each have their own bringing in enabling statute.
Individual enabling statutes that were passed as to each institution, as I recall.
That is correct, Your Honor. And within each of those enabling statutes, it specifies procedures will be under Section 5, or it specifies all of 8307 is adopted. The bottom line is that the only way to do what I think the Court of Appeals did and what the Attorney General insists is by implying something that just simply is not written into the statute, and by disregarding this decision in the Johnson case, the construction in second injury fund cases is only by the express unius rule, exclusivo alterius rule. I wish I could say that better, and I apologize that I can't. You know, looking at the fund sitting there, it's a benefit for the employers and the insurance companies to know that they contributed to it, that it's enabled them to employ people who might otherwise not be easily employable. And yet when you see it sitting there but can't get to it because of the jurisdictional roadblock of some implied unwritten rule being engrafted into claims against it, it's like Alice in Wonderland. She was down in Wonderland trying to figure out how to get home, and there on the tree was the Cheshire cat grinning at her, and she said, "Cat, how do I get home?" And the cat said, "Oh, you can get home." And the more that she pressed the cat on how to get home, the vaguer the cat became on its answers. And it began to disappear from the tail all the way up to the head until nothing was left but the grin. And she said, "You know, that's curious. I've often seen a cat without a grin, but I don't ever remember seeing a grin without a cat before." Well, that's how I feel about the fund. If these rules that are not literally put in the statute for people to read and to observe and to follow are implied in there, what is to prevent another rule being raised and inserted into the next claim against the fund? The claimant's not going to know. The employers and the insurance companies who have funded it are going to say, why on earth are we doing this if it can't be used to spread this risk around? I think everyone loses under those circumstances. For those reasons, I would urge this court to reinstate the judgment of the trial court and hold that Section 5 does not apply to this case. Thank you very much.
The court is now ready to hear arguments from the respondent.
Mr. Vernon Lawson will present argument for a respondent.
May it please the court. This is a workers' compensation case. That is, a claim for a suit for workers' compensation benefits under and subject to the provisions of the Texas Workers' Compensation Act. Unlike the individual enabling statutes with other state agencies, the second injury fund statutes are written within the Workers' Compensation Act itself, Article 8306. The statute that creates the remedy and sets forth what the worker is entitled to recover for an on-the-job injury. In contrast to Ms. Martinez's position in this case, we submit that a claim for compensation from the fund is, like every other claim for workers' compensation benefits, a statutory cause of action for which the statutes create the right to sue the fund in court and measure that right by the provisions of the Act.
Just not in the statute, though, is it?
Pardon?
That's just not in the statute.
Well, I think it is in the statute.
Impliedly.
It's in the statute by the legislative history of the Second Injury Fund Act and the prior decisions of this court and the Court of Appeals decisions in Mears and the Parker case that are cited in our brief.
Counsel, was the Mears case a venue case or not?
Not exclusively. The Mears case also involved a question of whether the suit for compensation benefits was a mandamus action that was exclusively cognizable in Travis County, or was it an appeal under the Workers' Compensation Act in accordance with Article 8307, Section 5. And the Court of Appeals decision in Mears, together with the explanation of that decision by this court in the Elder case, show that the courts specifically addressed the very question that's before the court today and found that Article 8307, Section 5 was intended to apply by the legislature to claims for compensation from the fund and expresses the legislature's waiver of sovereign immunity for those suits. In construing the statute, as the court knows, it is the intent of the legislature that is the goal of the effort. The intent of the legislature is the law itself, despite any conflict with the literal language of the statute. And in construing a comprehensive legislative plan such as the Workers' Compensation Act, you have to go further than applying one rule of statutory construction to one isolated provision of the Act to determine the legislature's intent. The legislature's intent on a distinctly similar question was decided by this court in the Guidry case in 1961, that by remaining silent as to the procedures to be followed in pursuing a claim for compensation from the Second Injury Fund and incorporating those statutes within the existing provisions of the Workers' Compensation Act, the legislature intended the claim to be prosecuted in accordance with the established procedures of that act.
The legislature now said, however, that you don't have to give the Second Injury Fund notice of the filing of the claim. Is that correct?
Yes.
Notice to the board is notice to the fund.
Yes. The legislature in 1977 reenacted the earlier provisions of the law that were considered by the courts in Guidry, Mears, Parker, and Elder. And with that exception, that on the specific holding of the Guidry case, on the specific question before the court on that point, the requirement of separate notice to the fund was no longer in effect.
So if we're looking for the intent of the legislature, why would we think that the legislature said that no notice was necessary of the claim, but notice is jurisdictional if you're going to sue the fund.
Because of two reasons. As the court observed in Guidry, if the legislature had intended to provide a different right to sue the second injury fund in court, or to provide different procedures or different time limitations to govern that right, it could easily have provided for those matters, just as it did in the 1977 amendment removing the requirement for separate notice. The second point is that unless we are to conclude by looking at this act as a whole, that the legislature intended to deny the possibility of pursuing a claim for compensation from the fund in court, we must conclude that it intended to afford that right. And that conclusion can only be given effect by continuing to follow the sound reasoning of the Guidry case, as the Court of Appeals has done, and holding Article 8307, Section 5 equally applicable to claims for compensation from the fund. That is where the claimant gets the right to sue. And I think that that is wholly consistent with the apparent intention of the legislature from this act.
Why is that the case when the liability of the fund is not established until the carrier's liability has been concluded?
Well, I would disagree with that also. This is another point from the Guidry opinion that was not changed in any way by the 1977 amendments to the legislation. Another question before the court in Guidry was the precise argument that is being made before the court today, that the worker could not have given notice or did not have to give notice to the second injury fund any earlier than he did, because he had no cause of action until after the carrier's liability had been decided. And the Guidry court answered that question by saying that the worker's cause of action under these statutes, virtually identical to the statutes that are in effect today, arose with the occurrence of the injury and did not arise by the carrier's stipulation of liability or the determination of its liability in a separate proceeding or anything of that nature. And I think that the prior decisions and the legislative history show that the cause of action accrues with the cause of action against the insurance company. It arises by virtue of the same injury. And it would at least be convenient to all concerned for the issues related to that cause of action to be determined in a joint proceeding.
Well, doesn't that mean that the claimant must prudently, and perhaps the carrier too, name the fund in every case where there's any claim or thought of total and permanent incapacity? There's a second injury. Any second injury case, you better name the second injury fund all along the way.
Well, I don't think there's any difference under the Workers' Compensation Act in pursuing a claim against the second injury fund and or between pursuing a claim against the insurance company.
Then your answer is yes.
If there has been...
Is your answer yes?
No, my answer is not yes.
To his question?
My answer is that the claim... The legislature has addressed these issues. The legislature has already spoken for what should be done, what additional limitations period is to be provided by the Act for the kind of change of condition that Mr. London has addressed. If there's a change of condition after the claim has been presented to the Industrial Action Board for administrative disposition, Article 8306, Section 12D provides the mechanism by which the board's jurisdiction can be reinvoked for a change of condition or a mistake or conditions of fraud or things of that nature.
So it's your position that prudent counsel appealing from an Industrial Accident Board decision might not necessarily name the second injury fund in every case. They could wait, they could postpone that decision on down the way and hope they could go back to the board or get to them some other way.
No, that's not my position. My position is that if there would be prudent for counsel to name the second injury fund in any case that falls within the description of the cause of action set forth by Article 8306, Section 12C1, as explained by this court's opinion in the Keaton case and in
And then is
INA versus no camper.
And then is the fund going to go litigate? They're going to go litigate all these cases. They're going to show up and appear and sit at council table.
Yes.
How is the fund prejudiced if it doesn't get noticed?
Well, the fund may be prejudiced. It's not, I don't think, really a question of whether the fund, as an account maintained in the state treasury, is being prejudiced by not following the procedures of the Workers' Compensation Act. The people who may be prejudiced are the handicapped workers that the fund was created to benefit. Those claimants who may legitimately be entitled to recover money from that fund. And it's the obligation of the state to preserve the assets of the fund for the benefit of those people. And to go in and participate in these proceedings for that purpose, and to ensure that the monies in the fund are used for the purpose the legislature placed them there, and that the insurance company retains its liability under the Workers' Compensation Act for the effects of the on-the-job injury. I do not think the interests of people who are entitled to receive money from the second injury fund are furthered by a procedure that envisions having the second injury fund's liability arise or be determined by the carrier's willingness to stipulate for reduced liability for a specific injury. Because if the carrier's liability is in fact not limited to compensation payable for a specific injury, it is liable for the compensation, and the money that's in the second injury fund should remain there for the payment to people who are entitled to receive it.
Petitioner says we don't have to address that question in this case, that even though the claimant may be bound by what happens in the trial against the carrier, perhaps the fund is not. Why doesn't that solve that problem?
Doesn't solve the problem because there's been no suggestion of what statute of limitations is to apply. If the statute of limitations the legislature has applied is not applied, then where do we go? By petitioner's arguments, the claims could be brought an uncertain number of years after the injury occurred. The purpose of the statute of limitations regarding claims against a second injury fund, as in any other case, is to require the exercise of a right within a reasonable time, so the opposing party has a fair opportunity to defend the claim or to determine the merits of the claim. And again, this court in Guidry has recognized that the second injury fund, under virtually identical statutory language, that the legislature intended the second injury fund to have all the protections and privileges it had given to the insurance companies under the Workers' Compensation Act. In this case, if there had been a change of condition, and Ms. Martinez's condition had grown worse after the suit was filed, as I said, the Workers' Compensation Act already contains a provision for what is to be done in that kind of circumstance. The existence of the second injury fund does not alter the provisions of the law that hold the carrier responsible for the effects of an on-the-job injury. And it does not alter the elementary principles of administrative law that have been consistently applied to the Workers' Compensation Act that requires a claim to first be presented to the Industrial Action Board for administrative disposition.
Couldn't the carrier stipulate to a lesser injury even if the second injury fund is in the lawsuit?
Well, yes, they could.
But the fund then would insist on trying the other issue as to whether it was a greater injury. What if the claimant produced his claim to the lesser injury? The carrier just admitted judgment.
Well, the carrier is an independent and separate party from the second injury fund, And whether it agrees and stipulates for reduced liability or not should not determine the second injury fund's liability. It may determine the carrier's liability to the claimant, but that is a matter of the claimant's election. And at least if the second injury fund was there and you had facts, for example, you had a person who had a prior injury and then an on-the-job injury to a specific member of his or her body, that aggravated the prior injury. I don't think it's unreasonable to foresee that the insurance company may point to the provisions regarding the second injury fund and try to persuade the claimant to accept their stipulation for reduced liability on the basis of an argument that he or she could then go pursue additional recovery from the second injury fund some other day. I don't think the legitimate interest of that claimant would be served by that procedure. If the second injury fund was there in the proceedings, then all the parties would be talking about the real issues and the true extent of the liability of the carrier and the amount of money that the claimant was legitimately entitled to receive from the fund. Article 8307, Section 5 is the only provision of the Workers' Compensation Act that gives any person or entity a right to sue under that act. It is our position that in creating the fund and in reenacting the earlier provisions of the law in 1977, the legislature intended the established procedures of the Workers' Compensation Act to apply to claims against the second injury fund, and specifically intended by Article 8307, Section 5, to allow Ms. Martinez and others a right to join the state of Texas in a suit to recover compensation from the fund by trial de novo. However, Article 8307, Section 5 does more than create the right to sue. It also requires compliance with the 20-day limitation period that has consistently been held to state a mandatory jurisdictional requirement. And that requirement simply was not met in this case.
Show me in the statute creating the second injury fund where it says that.
Where it says?
That you've got 20 days to give notice and 20 days from that day to file suit. Set aside the board's award.
It says that
the statute creating the second injury fund.
Well, in Article 8306, Section 12C through 12C2, there's no mention of that.
That is a second injury fund statute, isn't it?
Yes, but it's also part of the Workers' Compensation Act.
It's a separate statute enacted after the Workers' Compensation statute was first adopted in 1913.
Yes.
Is that not correct?
That's correct. But I wouldn't say that it's necessarily a separate statute. It is part of the Workers' Compensation Act.
Well, you just got through making the point that every one of these statutes that brought the University of Texas into the workers' compensation system and Texas A&M University were separate statutes. And you said that had great significance. Why is that not the same separate, and this provide the same significance as to the second injury?
Well, I'm not sure I'm correctly stating my position. And, my position is that I think the legislature intended to allow Ms. Martinez to bring the state of Texas into a suit and recover compensation from the fund in court. But I see no provision of the law that supports that contention. If the only provision of the Workers' Compensation Act that allows a suit to be filed is held not applicable to her claim, that can only lead to the result that she has no right to sue. And I think that defeats the legislative purpose in creating the fund.
Has the second injury fund been sued successfully since 1947 when it was created?
Yes.
It hadn't seemed to bother anybody up till now.
Not as far as I can tell. I do have several other needs. And, well, Unless there are other questions. We request that the holding of the Court of Appeals be affirmed and Ms. Martinez seek for compensation from the second entity fund be dismissed for lack of jurisdiction.
Any questions?
Thank you. I'll try to confine my reply to that, to a reply. I take issue with his interpretation of the Mears case for several reasons. I contend that Mears really was simply a venue case in that at that time, Venue and Workers' Compensation Act was literally under 8307 Section 5, but was not jurisdictional. Venue and Workers' Compensation Act now is not under Section 5. It's a completely separate statute, 8307A. And that change occurred in the same legislative period, 1977, when all of these other fund changes took place, too. In other words, the statute upon which Mears' decision was reached, the venue statute, was no longer applicable to second injury fund cases after 1977. It would be erroneous to contend that Mears was more than a venue case to the extent 8307 Section 5 was mentioned at all in the Mears case. The other reason I take issue with his interpretation of Mears, I think he suggested that Mears held that the consent to sue the state at all was construed to arise out of the existence of 8307 Section 5, and that's just not how I read that case. Mears, as I read it, and I read it again last night, said that the consent to sue was by virtue of the existence of 8306 Section 12C. The creation of the fund itself and the definition of its procedures is the consent to sue, not this 20-day to appeal, 20-day to file suit statute that's at issue in this lawsuit. He also took the position, as I understand it, that the 1977 legislature essentially returned second injury fund proceedings to the way they had been back in the Guidry and Parker days, and that's absolutely incorrect. The legislature took the Guidry and Parker decisions on notice and claim and said this prevents a claimant from having access to the fund, and so we're going to take notice and claim right out of the law. They eliminated the procedural hurdles rather than sticking procedural hurdles back in. If the 1977 legislature had read every case on the books involving the second injury fund, they would never have found a case saying that the 20-day appeal, 20-day file suit rules were jurisdictional in a second injury fund case. There would have been no reason for them to write a new statute addressing a question that had never been decided before. Instead, they wrote a statute solving a problem that impeded access to the fund. They wrote a statute taking notice and claim out of the process. And I want to reiterate, notice and claim are not jurisdictional. They're waivable. That has been the law since the statute was first enacted back in the 1913 timeframe. The other problem that I had with his argument, for the first time I've been told in argument today that the change of condition statute, Section 12D, would perhaps be available in case a claimant got worse. Well, that simply will not apply. The reason it won't apply is because the change of condition statute applies to someone whose condition gets worse. A second injury fund case does not apply to worsening conditions. It applies to two specific injuries, a previous specific injury, as in this case, polio to the right leg, and an on-the-job injury to another specific member of the body. The suggestion has been, well, if the carrier just goes over and lays down, then the fund doesn't get to defend itself because the carrier has laid down and just given up on this 100% specific injury, for example, to the leg. But the statute doesn't work that way. The only way the fund will ever owe any money at all is if there are two specific injuries and the carrier only pays for the second specific injury. An old specific injury and a new specific injury are fund cases. A new specific injury and a new general injury might make the carrier liable for total and permanent by extending and affecting the body, but that general injury is what lets the fund off the hook.
But the fund suggests that the carrier might be inclined to strike a bargain with the claimant to accept benefits for a lesser specific injury that would still result in total and permanent incapacity.
It'd be impossible, because the only way that could happen is by the combination of two specific injuries, the carriers on the one hand and the funds on the other. If the fund comes in and proves that the total and permanent is because of a new specific injury and an old general injury, then it doesn't owe anything. The carrier can't stipulate as to the existence of that other injury. All it could concede is what it owed for the new specific injury, which is the fund's underlying condition precedent. For example, the carrier says, we're facing a leg case. Now, we can either pay this leg, or we can fight it and run the risk of having the leg extend to and affect the body and pay T&P.
Or perhaps convince the claimant that he ought to just take the foot instead of...
No, because there's a case on the books, and since this didn't come up, I didn't brief it, but there's a case on the books that says two members of the same body group, a foot and a leg, for example, or a toe and a foot, or a finger and a hand, are not two specific injuries. They are, by virtue, lesser included injuries of the same members. I didn't brief it because it just hadn't come up before now. I think we're left with that nagging problem, and that is that there not being a specific statutory requirement, then how will the bar know what to do? And the only thing the bar can do is sue that firm in every case involving specific injury.
Just in case.
It would not help the business, the insurance, the claimant, or the fund. It would just break the system down with a bunch of litigation that may not appear to be meritorious at the time litigation is filed. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes arguments.